This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. When a person preaches extreme anti-Semitism and sees Jews as the center of an international financial conspiracy, you might presume this person is uneducated, unsophisticated, and easily duped. So how do you explain Henry Ford, one of America's greatest industrialists? While he was building the Ford Motor Company and putting America on the road with his Model T, he was also publishing excerpts of the anti-Semitic book The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. In fact, Hitler became one of his admirers. Neil Baldwin is the author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's now out in paperback. Baldwin is the author of earlier biographies of Thomas Alva Edison and William Carlos Williams. Terry spoke with him last January about Henry Ford's racist past. Ford owned the Dearborn Independent, a country newspaper in Dearbornville, Michigan. For 6 months after he bought it, the paper was an all-purpose, feature-oriented publication. But then Ford began to use it as a platform for his anti-Semitic views.
In 1920, he started publishing a series in the Dearborn Independent called The International Jew, The World's Problem. This ran for 91 weeks, this series. What kind of information did he print in this series?
What happened was he had a lieutenant who was the general manager of the Independent, whose name was E.G. Liebold, who was of Prussian-German descent. And Mr. Liebold was a self-styled scholar of anti-Semitism, and he began to assemble a complete library of anti-Jewish literature going back to the 17th century, and Ford gave him a budget, actually, to acquire these works. And at some point in the early 1920, Liebold met a Russian emigre named Boris Bressel, who was an anti-Tsarist who had come to this country to spread the word of anti-Bolshevism. And Bressel had a transcript of the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, which is probably the single most harmful anti-Jewish tract ever created. It was a forgery that had roots in turn-of-the-century Russia around the time of the first Zionist Congress, actually. And it was purportedly, the protocols is another word for minutes, it was purportedly the minutes of a worldwide gathering of the high rabbis gathering in outside Prague, at the cemetery of Prague, to discuss their plan for world domination. And Bressel was able to get a copy of this into the hands of Liebold. And this tract was serialized in the Dearborn Independent, kind of like each article that attacked a different aspect of the Jewish problem or the Jewish question had an epigraph from the Protocols of the Elders of Zion kind of before the lead paragraph to set the tone for whatever criticism of the Jews was being put forth.
What were some of the main points that the Protocols made about the Jews?
Ford personally resonated so well with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion because the main kind of the informing theme of the protocols was world domination through financial means. The major theme of the protocols is we, being the Jewish people, the Jewish race, as it was called at that time, are going to infiltrate the banks, and we are going to become the wire pullers of the world economy. We are going to become the government behind the government. The way that we are going to subvert the world rulership is through the economic system. And Ford accepted this wholeheartedly because he was so inherently defensive anyway about the Eastern banking establishment and about Wall Street and about the international bankers, the Rothschilds, and the, you know, he had all these generic terms for the, he even thought of J.P. Morgan as part of that that group, and he felt very, very threatened by the banking system.
Can you talk a little bit about the conspiratorial language that was used in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
Well, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were written, as I've sort of been implying, they were written in the first person plural. The whole premise of it is that someone was at this secret meeting of these chief rabbis from all around the world, and someone was taking notes and writing down exactly what they were saying. And they kind of took each dimension of society and each dimension of culture in order. So they first discussed the banks, then they discussed another sore spot with Ford, which was the concept of Jews as warmongers. So it would say something like, we are going to instigate the governments of European countries to go to war against each other so that we can then weaken their infrastructure and take over control. The word control was a tremendous buzzword throughout the protocols. And again, you have this sense of solidarity. There's a whole other subtext in the protocols about, which actually sort of in Ford's view, paved the way for the Zionist movement, because there's this other section about we are going to establish a country especially for ourselves in Zion, and we will call this country, you know, we will call this country Zion, and we will encourage all Jews to pay homage to this country and to gravitate there, and then we will establish the seat of our world government there. So there's all this kind of sense of solidarity and Jews as one entity, one consistent entity that eventually en masse is going to rise up.
What is known about who actually wrote the Protocols of the Elders of Zion?
In fact, very little is known. As a matter of fact, to this day, the actual authorship of the protocols is not known. What is known, there's a school of thought that believes that the earlier iteration or roots for the protocols can be traced to the period in France known as the emancipation of, quote-unquote, emancipation of the Jews, which would be the late 18th century. And the second iteration, which is the more concrete and longer-lasting one, came at about 1897, to be exact. And that date happens to coincide with the first Zionist Congress, which took place in Basel, Theodor Herzl, and so forth, which is why many scholars believe that the Protocols of the Elders of Zion were put forth to cast aspersions on the Zionist movement. They were put forth as an antidote or as an opposition to the Zionist movement by an anonymous group of writers, anti-Semites, in Tsarist Russia.
Had the protocols spread much before Henry Ford published it, and what was the impact of his publication?
What happened was the articles in the Dearborn Independent, as I say, there were almost 100 of them, and starting in the fall of 1920, Ford began to anthologize these articles into four separate pamphlets. Each one had about 20, 25 articles in it. The pamphlets were called, had the overall headline of The International Jew, the World's Foremost Problem. These, the earliest publication, 1920, 1921, they found their way over to Germany, and they were published by Theodor Fritsch, who was a virulent anti-Semite in the very early 20s, translated them into German, and they went through 21 printings in 1921 and 1922 alone. They took off like wildfire in Germany, in Munich especially.
So Henry Ford, in a way, helped stir up anti-Semitism in Germany.
If you were a visitor to Adolf Hitler's office in Munich, in the waiting room of Hitler's office, on a sort of low coffee table, was a sort of a display, like spread out, kind of fanned out across the table of the International Jew in the German versions. And then when you were finally welcomed into the inner office, you would find a portrait of Henry Ford on the wall, behind Hitler's desk. And this is 1922. This is 16 years before Kristallnacht. In Mein Kampf, he specifically gives credit and admiration to Henry Ford as being the only American. He says, oh, there was only one great American, Ford, who understands what we are trying to do here in Germany.
How did Jewish groups respond to Ford's anti-Semitism and the anti-Semitic tracts that he was publishing?
The dialectical nature of this problem was what first sucked me into the exploration in the first place. I felt, as you've just implied, I mean, I felt that how would the Jewish leadership go up against somebody of this popularity and this clout, this household name, this brand, actually, human brand in a sense? How to deal with Ford came down to this very essential problem. Do you go up against him in a very aggressive, public way, i.e., petitions, boycotting the purchase of Ford automobiles, letter-writing campaign, telegraphing him, etc.? Do you take the public aggressive view, or, as Jacob Schiff, the elder statesman of the Jewish community, recommended at the time, do you assume that Ford is a lunatic, quote-unquote, and that, quote, this will pass? And as Jacob Schiff advised his colleagues very strongly, if we go up against Henry Ford, I think he wrote in a letter, this will light a fire that will never be extinguished in our lifetime. We must allow him to essentially burn out and not dignify him with opposition in any way. That was the huge quandary that the American Jewish community faced when Henry Ford started publishing those articles.
Neil Baldwin speaking with Terry Gross. Baldwin is the author of Henry Ford and the Jews, The Mass Production of Hate. It's just out in paperback. We'll hear more of their conversation when we return. This is Fresh Air. Back now to our interview with Neil Baldwin, author of Henry Ford and the Jews.
How did Ford's public display of anti-Semitism end?
Finally, in the summer of 1927, there was a libel suit brought against Ford in federal district court in Detroit by a man named Aaron Shapiro, who was a former rabbi and an attorney from California, who had actually launched the collective bargaining farming movement in America. He was a pioneer in educating farmers to get together and act in solidarity and help them raise prices and control the flow of their products and so forth. When Ford got wind of Aaron Shapiro's activities, he ordered a series of slanderous articles against him as a Jew daring to infiltrate farming and agriculture, which was a complete anathema to him. And Ford was sued by Shapiro, and the trial commenced, and Ford's lieutenants were called to the stand, and slowly the testimony unfurled. The attribution of Ford being, quote-unquote, the spark plug of the Jewish series, the fact that even though he hadn't written these articles himself, he was the instigation, it was his money, it was his ideas, it was his philosophy. And on the brink of being called to the stand himself, Ford issued a retraction, an apology to the Jewish people, which was drafted by Louis Marshall, the head of the American Jewish Committee. It was published in hundreds of newspapers through the Hearst syndicate throughout the country, and Ford, you know, essentially settled out of court with Shapiro rather than have to go up and actually talk himself about what he had or had not been doing.
So when Henry Ford issued his retraction, a retraction that was actually written by a leader in the Jewish community, what did the retraction say?
The narrative of the retraction is as if he's saying, first of all, I unwittingly cast aspersions on the general populace of Jews. I didn't really mean to create such a furor of, by these unprovoked reflections. He admitted that the pamphlets had been distributed in other countries, and he said that those now had his, quote, unqualified disapproval, and that henceforth there would be no more writings against the Jews in the Dearborn Independent. These are points that Lewis Marshall, as an attorney, was trying to score. And once he found out that Ford was going to allow whatever he wrote to be published, he went ahead and covered as many bases as he could. The fact, the historical fact of the matter is that the major premise of this apology, which was the cessation of any further publication, did nothing, of course, to prevent the dissemination of everything that had come before. And Ford actually promised that he would no longer allow the Protocols or the International Jew to be published with his name on it. But since it was never copyrighted by him or by Liebold or Cameron, there was no way that he could enforce that. That's a very important point.
So the Protocols continued to be published, continued to be spread around the world, in spite of Henry Ford's repudiation.
That's right.
You know, although after the trial that you discussed, Ford stopped publishing his anti-Semitic tracts, his anti-Semitic influence didn't end there. Would you talk a little bit about what Ford's influence was and what Ford's financial interests were in Nazi Germany?
Hitler sent an emissary to America in the early years, before he had even ascended to full power of the Reich. He sent an emissary to this country named Kurt Ludeke, a fundraiser, essentially a fundraiser for the Reich. And he instructed him to be sure and pay a call on Henry Ford. This was in the early 1920s. And Ludeke came to Detroit, and he was able to get a private meeting with Henry Ford. And Ford denied, subsequent to that, that he ever gave funding directly to Nazi Germany or to Adolf Hitler. I think that Ford's support of Hitler is ideological rather than financial. In my research, I was not able to uncover any paper trail directly leading to Hitler from Ford with a financial edge to it. Now, that being said, Henry Ford knew very early on that Germany was a rich, could be a rich potential source for his company. In 1924 and 1925, he already had a factory in place in Berlin and was producing cars over there. And there's no question that for about 15-year period there, Fords were a popular brand in Germany leading up to World War II. That, and again, I must qualify that by saying that many American companies were participating in the economy of Germany at that time. And it's ironic because General Motors actually had a much larger share of the market for the first decade or so that the car companies were, American car companies had a presence in Germany. Starting in the earliest years of World War II, however, Ford began to produce materiel and trucks and jeeps and vehicles of a more useful nature to the Germans.
What has Ford done since the death of Henry Ford to make amends for all of the anti-Semitism that Henry Ford was responsible for?
As soon as Henry Ford II took over the chairmanship of the company, which is 1945, Hank the Deuce, as he was known, as he was called by Lee Iacocca and others, he immediately issued various statements and declarations, public pronouncements about the Ford Motor Company position on Jews and its philosophy of equality for all people. And Ford, as a company, was one of the most ardent supporters of the nascent and emerging state of Israel financially, in terms of producing cars over there. And in the 5 or 6 decades since then, there's no question that the Ford family and the Ford Motor Company no longer, you know, has no trace of the legacy of its founder. This was something that began with Henry Ford and ended with Henry Ford. There's no question in my mind about that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Neil Baldwin's book, Henry Ford and the Jews, is just out in paperback. Terry Gross spoke with him last January. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.